Online in Business. Voice America Business.
Welcome to Three Dimensional Wealth with Roe Diefendorf, your source for total wealth management. All comments, views, and opinions expressed on the show are solely those of Roe, his guests, and callers. Now let's begin the show. Here's your host, Roe Diefendorf.
Thank you for joining me on Three Dimensional Wealth. I'm your host, Roe Diefendorf, and I'm here with Paul Shervish. And Paul is the professor of sociology and the director of the Boston College Center of Wealth and Philanthropy. And he's also on the National Research Fellow at Indiana University Center of Philanthropy. He's a senior advisor to John Templeton Foundation and to the Wealth and Giving Forum, and an international roundtable for wealth holders to reflect on and discuss their charitable giving in a peer environment. Paul has served as a distinguished visiting professor of philanthropy at Indiana University Center in Philanthropy, and as a Fulbright Professor of Philanthropy at the University College in Cork, Ireland. He's steeped in the Jesuit education himself, having been an undergraduate literature major at the University of Detroit, and he's also received a Master's of Divinity degree at the Jesuit School of Theology at Berkeley. Now, today he specializes on patterns and motivations of charitable giving, on the meaning of moral biography in an age of affluence, and on a discernment of daily life as a spiritual exercise. Well, we want to talk today with you about what's new in philanthropy, because you're the guy that's doing it. Paul, welcome.
Roy, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Listen, as an academician, you know, I'm interested in what got you interested in philanthropy.
Well, it's a good story, because what got me interested in philanthropy was a philanthropist, a gentleman, Tom Murphy, from Detroit area. Everybody asked me if it's the General Motors Tom Murphy. It is not. Was an alumnus of Boston College, came to the development office, and asked if there was a contact with a dean he could make so that he could contact some researchers to answer a question. So we got together, several economists, sociologists, myself, and some psychology professors. And here's his question. And it really is the question of the age, I think, in terms of philanthropy and wealth. And it's the question that has shaped, I'm surprised to find out, almost everything what we have done and where we have returned. And that question is, when people become financially secure or have redundant wealth, do they become more involved in philanthropy? And I told them I know the answer. Sometimes yes, and sometimes no. But if you want to know more about what makes it yes, and when it's yes, and what makes it no, and when it's no, then we could do a research study. And so this has been exactly the question that we now formulate as moral biography. It gets down to resources are more or deeply understood as a capacity, and it could be financial capacity, wealth, directing an army, owning a business, having a government position, your intellectual capital, your connections, your suasive personality. All these are your capacities. These are the resources. And the other part is, what do you want to direct them toward? See, all these resources are innate. They're not active until they're put in motion by an aspiration, a purpose, a desire, a moral bearing, a fear, some kind of energy that mobilizes these resources and has people take action and direct that action to some end. And so this has been the question that we have. And so if wealth is more generally resources, and then we can talk about all kinds of resources, and philanthropy is more basically care for anybody. So philanthropy is one form of financial care nested in financial morality, and then financial morality or financial care is nested in care in general. So I've begun to see that the real issue is not philanthropy. The real issue is a way of life of wealth.
Let me ask you, I did a presentation on philanthropy at the Cold Spring Harbor DNA Center. This is where they discovered DNA.
Mm-hmm.
It's world renowned, and I was there about a week or 10 days ago. And while I was waiting to give this presentation, I was walking around the exhibit room, and one of the displays said, "It's the moral DNA." Okay? Now you said it's the, you know, we didn't say quite say moral compass, but how do you feel about that? I was just curious because they said it's the DNA, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, there are things you can do about it, but what they're saying by the moral DNA is that there are inclinations. You see, there was a period of time when, especially that grew out of the utilitarian period in the 18th century, when human beings were defined as calculating their self-interest. And so if you shared some bread with somebody that was hungry, that was in your self-interest, otherwise you wouldn't have done it. If you jump into a river to save somebody who's drowning, the question the economists ask is not what are you feeling, the question is what did you do? And what did you do? You jumped in the river to save the person, therefore you had an interest in it. Now, once you define utilitarianism in that way, and you define all human action that way, there's no way out of that conundrum. It's a reductionist argument. Now, with this DNA and what comes out of sociobiology and some research over the last 25 years, really, is that there is this instinct that we want to talk about in animals, and inclination probably is more in a judging animal like a human being, where the instinct doesn't automatically determine activity. The discovery that there is something that is what they call altruistic, but is not altruistic in the sense of pure selflessness. The animals are not purely selfless. They have a instinctual rationale, a biological rationale for what appears to be sacrificial behavior. They are passing along or protecting the gene pool of their tribe, let me say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is very much in tune with the way I have been talking about the inclination toward philanthropy. See, in the old versions, we had to come up with the notion of altruism as selflessness because everything supposedly was self-interested. So where's the human spirit? Where's the human nobility? And so we came up with altruism as selflessness, kind of a modern notion of altruism. But with this biopsychology and biosociology that we're developing and the genetic aspects of it, we're confirming what I've been saying all along, which is if you go back to the ancient traditions, altruism or doing what is a benefit for others is not done by a selfless person. It's not the absence of self, it's the connection of self. So it's a quality of self, not the absence of self. And if you look at even the animals then, it is not just an absence of self, it's a self that is connected. So to explain somebody jumping in the river to save a five-year-old son or daughter who has stumbled off a bridge or something, and when you ask people, what are they feeling? They're not feeling selfless, they're feeling more connected to ever. Than ever. They want to get attached closer to the object of their love. And so more and more I'm looking at philanthropy as an inclination that can be developed, can be educated, can be matured, but there is this natural psychological and sociological orientation toward caring for those who are your flesh and blood. And that can be violated, of course, but once that is there, then the question is, what's the experience of that? What's the happiness of that? And how do you want to extend it out in space and time and bloodline? And so I am very much attuned to and see what is being said about the genetic dimensions of this as complementary to where I'm going. I may discover otherwise as more comments and theories come out of that, but right now it's quite congenial.
So you can make a career out of all of this, can't you?
Make a career out of what? Excuse me.
I said, out of all of the academia that you've just taught me, you can make a career out of this, and you're doing it at Boston College.
Well, you can make a career out of it, not because it's a bright idea. You can make a career out of it because it's needed.
Okay.
That's what an entrepreneur is. And this is what Tom Murphy brought me into consciousness to doing. Wealth holders have needs, and they have unmet needs. Now, their needs for accumulation, for investment, are pretty well taken care of. But what isn't taken care of is the meaning of the allocation of their wealth, one dimension of which is philanthropy. And so when people, well, let me put it the way I usually do. When it is no longer of high importance to achieve a greater standard of living for yourself or your heirs, or to accumulate more money, people begin to ask deeper questions and to look for a way of life that provides them with answers to these deeper questions. And I think that is one of the key questions of the 21st century. How will wealth open up an avenue for people to use their wealth as an instrument for deeper purposes when acquiring more wealth or a greater standard of living is no longer of high importance? And what's new in philanthropy today is that so many people in our nation and across the world are reaching that point where philanthropy can become not just an ordinary activity, but an extraordinary activity and regular at the same time.
Paul Shervis, stay with us. We're going to have more of you after this break, and so we'll be back with more Three-Dimensional Wealth. Stay tuned.
The bottom line in business. Voice America Business.
Going nowhere as a financial professional? Enroll today at the American College. The American College is the nation's oldest and largest distance learning institution devoted to financial services education. Research has shown that graduates of the American College's Chartered Life Underwriter and Chartered Financial Consultant programs average 20% higher production income than their peers without professional designations. For more information, visit theamericancollege.edu. That's theamericancollege.edu, the education you need to succeed.
Financial planning can be confusing and complex, and unless you have a solid game plan, you could be taking unnecessary risks and missing out on tremendous opportunities. Let Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates take the mystery out of investing and help you build a solid financial foundation for years to come. Diefendorf Capital Planning revolves around the family, and through our financial service companies and three-dimensional wealth centers, we strive to deliver total wealth management financially, personally, and socially. Learn more about what Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates can do for you. Visit the website at diefendorfcapital.com today. Integrity, full service, best in class, diefendorfcapital.com.
investment management is more than picking a good stock. In fact, a good company may not be a good investment. With today's complex financial products, it becomes critical to employ a true professional on your team. That's where the members of IMCA, the Investment Management Consultants Association, comes in. These professionals have proven themselves to be the best in the business. So when looking to get a second opinion on your portfolio, look for individuals with the CIMA designation. That's Certified Investment Management Analyst, a cut above the rest. Brought to you by the NYC chapter of IMCA.
The Internet's only all business and financial radio network, Voice America Business.
Bringing you the keys to total wealth management, this is Three-Dimensional Wealth with Roey Diefendorf. Comments or questions? Visit www.diefendorfcapital.com or call 516-759-3900. Now back to the show. Here's Roey Diefendorf.
Our show for today is entitled, What's New in Philanthropy? And I have with me Paul Shervish on the line, and he is a professor of sociology and the director of Boston College's Center on Wealth and Philanthropy. Paul, maybe you can give us a little background on what BC is doing in this area, and really the leader, I think, in the nation.
Well, thank you for saying that. We were the first to really begin to study not just philanthropy as a system, but philanthropists, the supply side, where the money comes from, that is producing the output in philanthropy. Now, our institute really does the things that you've already mentioned in describing us. First of all, we have taken the lead in describing and analyzing the empirical patterns of philanthropy in the nation. What are the various dimensions of philanthropy? How do you connect? What is the relation between wealth and philanthropy? Other empirical work has been our $41 trillion estimate of wealth transfer between 1998 and 2052, which has made quite a mark in the nation. Then the patterns are simply the framework. And then we start also emphasizing the meaning of philanthropy, the deeper meaning, the philosophical meaning, the religious meaning, the psychological meaning. And what we really do is pick that up from the people we interview.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I think we're most proud of is that we don't make up what we say, but garner it from the people who are living philanthropy in their lives or not living it. And in those interviews, we're able to come up with understandings that go beyond what those people would be able to say themselves, but in the end, they say, yeah, that's me. And that's the key to good interview research. And so we capture the meaning of philanthropy, and maybe later we'll talk about that basic meaning as philia, and I'll talk about a deeper approach to philanthropy that really is a way of considering how you live your daily life in society. And then we look at the motives for philanthropy. A long time ago, we stopped thinking of motives, like many people do, as high motives and low motives, as altruistic motives in that outmoded sense that I dismissed earlier, and high-intentioned motives. So we have selfish motives and noble motives. Well, instead of looking at it that way, which you have to make a judgment from the outside about people,
uh-huh,
I looked at motive in the basic sense of the Latin word movere. And motive comes from that word, which means to move. So I look at motives as what mobilizes, what moves people or hinders them from moving toward philanthropy. So we've come up with five or six major motives that we think affect wealth holders, and another five or six that are quite universal across the population. And finally, we are working these days on a national survey that the Gates Foundation provided the seed money for. And although you read studies of the wealthy from U.S. Trust and Bank of America and other groups that put out wealth studies, if you read the methodology and read the introduction, it is generally the case that the average level of net worth or investable assets that the population has that they're studying is $2 to $3 million, or $200,000 to $300,000 in income. So essentially, these studies may get a few cases of what we might consider the truly wealthy. They're generally, although called wealth studies, studies of the affluent. Now, our Gates study, and it's also being supported at the present by Wachovia Caliber, because they offered us an opportunity to work closely with their 200 to 300 high net worth clients, and they are excited about having each one of their clients take this survey. It's a survey to be taken online, and it's for people who have a net worth of $25 million or above. So it's going to be a true wealth study. We have some connections to have billionaires take it. We certainly have many people that are going to be able to help us with the 10,000 hundred millionaires and people that have $100 million in net worth. And then there's, just to continue, there's 10,000 households, maybe 11,000 now, that are at $100 million or more. And then 25 million or more is about 114,000 households. So we're up there in the high stratosphere with this study.
And the purpose or the result? You're doing the study. What's
It's up? Not research. Research is not an end in itself.
Okay.
Our goal is to have a body of knowledge developed for two kinds or three kinds of reflections. First of all, when people take our survey, wealth holders, it is itself a cause for reflection. We ask several questions that they have to answer that enable them to think more deeply about issues in ways they may not have done so previously and to articulate them. Second, the results of the survey can be used by professionals, advisors, fundraisers, therapists, community foundations to gather wealth holders so that they can be more reflective, use it as an occasion to discuss in a more reflective way the allocation purposes, motives, and meanings for philanthropy and other uses of their money during their lifetime and at their death. Ultimately, our concern is to create some knowledge that will lead to some programming that will lead wealth holders and the affluent to do something that is brand new in history for so many people. That is to allocate their wealth wisely for the care of others.
Paul, how do you dream this stuff up?
I don't sleep.
Okay.
You see where this is going. It becomes a means, like Shakespeare said, 'twere as a mirror held up to nature. So the survey is a mirror held up to their nature that they can reflect on. And then this can be used to, for instance, in Boston, if we do the Boston Foundation's Boston area study of 25 million and above households, one of the things they're hoping to do eventually is to gather wealth holders and not dictate projects, but to gather them so that they will, from the bottom up, help to coordinate their own philanthropic activities in the Boston area.
Mm.
And you see, this is something new in history where so many people, at such a young age, with so much energy and so much intelligence, can devote themselves on a regular basis and on a deep basis to non-commercial activity for the care of others. That has never happened before in history.
Who else is doing this kind of research around the country?
Well, I don't think anybody is putting together the historical, the theological, the philosophical, going back to Aristotle, and the empirical the way we do. But another group that does study the motives and trends among philanthropists is the Indiana University Center on Philanthropy in Indianapolis. And that is a group I'm affiliated with, and they have put together over the years a really stunning array of programs and projects. They have incorporated into the Center on Wealth and Philanthropy a Women in Philanthropy subsection. They are the people that produce the statistical Bible of charitable giving statistics, Giving USA each year. They are the ones that have run the fundraising school to teach fundraisers the methodology of fundraising. They also have the Lake Family Center on Religion and Philanthropy. So they really have a cross-cutting set of interests and a wide body of faculty interested, not only at the Indianapolis campus, but at the Bloomington campus and at the other campuses of the system. So they have had some great advantages in funding from Lilly and from Atlantic Philanthropies and other major funders, and they have been good stewards of the money and have blossomed as probably the leading overall institute in the country.
I read an article.
I'm just glad they're my friends.
Yeah. I read an article that you wrote back January, 2006. It was Leaving a Legacy of Care. You want to comment on that? Because it wasn't a legacy of money. It was a legacy of care.
Yes. This goes back to what I was talking about earlier when I said that philanthropy is something that is nested in the way we use our money morally, our financial morality. Now, our financial morality has financial care in it, but not all of it is philanthropic. You can have financial care for your workers. You can have financial care for your brothers and sisters or their children. You can have financial care for paying your workers life and medical insurance when the market doesn't insist that you do. So there's all kinds of realms of financial care, how you invest, how you spend. But that's nested in the broader category of care in daily life. Now, what we want to teach our children, we sometimes think, is how to carry out the values that we have cherished and have hoped to communicate to them during our lives. Now, there's always some leakage there. I mean, I was happy the other day that my boy said, "Dad, when I grow up, I'm going to be cheap like you." But when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit more about this leaving a legacy of care rather than just a legacy of money and not just a legacy of philanthropy.
Oh, so after
something special for these kids.
I'm glad you said that. Well, stay tuned. We are going to be back with more Three-Dimensional Wealth and Paul Shervish, so stay tuned.
The bottom line in business. Voice America Business.
Investment management is more than picking a good stock. In fact, a good company may not be a good investment. With today's complex financial products, it becomes critical to employ a true professional on your team. That's where the members of IMCA, the Investment Management Consultants Association, comes in. These professionals have proven themselves to be the best in the business. So when looking to get a second opinion on your portfolio, look for individuals with a CIMA designation. That's Certified Investment Management Analyst, a cut above the rest. Brought to you by the NYC chapter of IMCA. going nowhere as a financial professional? Enroll today at the American College. The American College is the nation's oldest and largest distance learning institution devoted to financial services education. Research has shown that graduates of the American College's Chartered Life Underwriter and Chartered Financial Consultant programs average 20% higher production income than their peers without professional designations. For more information, visit theamericancollege.edu. That's theamericancollege.edu, the education you need to succeed.
Financial planning can be confusing and complex, and unless you have a solid game plan, you could be taking unnecessary risks and missing out on tremendous opportunities. Let Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates take the mystery out of investing and help you build a solid financial foundation for years to come. Diefendorf Capital Planning revolves around the family, and through our financial service companies and three-dimensional wealth centers, we strive to deliver total wealth management financially, personally, and socially. Learn more about what Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates can do for you. Visit the website at diefendorfcapital.com today. Integrity, full service, best in class, diefendorfcapital.com.
The Internet's only all business and financial radio network, Voice America Business.
We now return to three-dimensional wealth with Roy Diefendorf. Direct your questions and comments to www.diefendorfcapital.com or call 516-759-3900. Now the host of three-dimensional wealth, Roy Diefendorf.
Welcome back. My guest for today is Paul Shervish. We're discussing philanthropy. And the question just before we took the break is, you know, how can you use philanthropy to carry out the values that we cherish? How does that work?
Well, I want to back up a little bit, and I hope that people will understand this shift, but it's an organic shift in my thinking. And when you ask what's new in philanthropy, I hope what I'm saying is something new. I am getting to the point where I no longer privilege what I call formal charitable giving as any kind of special use of people's money. Remember I said you want to leave people a legacy of care.
Mm-hmm.
What we're hoping to teach people is how to carry out care in the world. Now, this wonderful Jesuit theologian, Jules Toner, did a kind of phenomenology of love. And by reading and looking at newspapers and reading novels and television and talking to people, he concluded that all human beings get to a point where they know the difference between treating another as a immoral end and treating another as a unconditional end. And that's love. But then he says, we got to be more practical than that. What is love in practice? What is this affective, this emotional attachment to others in practice? And he calls that care, the instrumental or implemental aspect of love. And then he says, what's care? Care is meeting the true needs of others. Now, the Sufis have this little set of paragraphs where they talk about how a good person wants to treat others in the same way he or she has been treated. And a generous person or generous people want to treat others in a way better than they're treated. And this sounds just right, doesn't it? But the Sufis go on to say, do not indulge in being good or generous. They say, be wise and treat others in the way they need to be treated. Mm-hmm. And so the deepest obligation for the distribution or allocation of money is to do what is needed. Now, what is needed sometimes isn't automatically formal philanthropy. Let's say there's a Down syndrome niece or nephew or child. And one of the things the families always worry about is how are they going to pay the medical expenses later in life, or what's going to happen to the child after the parents who have been these caretakers all the time when they die. And I've had wealth holders tell me how they've endowed a sick or disabled relative so that there is an ability to attend every family function and to have some functioning in the world that is normal. And that's not philanthropic in the technical sense. You understand what I'm saying. It's not to a charity. But it's philanthropic in the way that I'm talking about it. You see, I want to have philanthropy be everywhere, but I don't privilege formal philanthropy. Here's where I get my idea. Aristotle talks about what the meaning of philia is. And that is a certain kind of love. And we often define philanthropy as love of humankind. But we get closer to the meaning of philanthropy when we talk about Philadelphia as the city of brotherly love. So philia has more to do with some kind of kinship love. And for Aristotle, the root of philia is friendship love. Now, what is friendship? Friendship is two beings in one soul. A friend is another self. And so I am looking for a way to talk about this age of affluence and this age of wealth and what allocation is all about in these broader terms. Where are you using your resources, whether they be money or they be your talents, for what needs to be done in your sphere, and as you expand your sphere outward in time and space and kinship? But that what needs to be done is not necessarily philanthropy in the formal sense. It is always philia in the sense that it is friendship love, which means mutual nourishment between two people. So you can see how we would do our philanthropy in the general sense, in the philia sense, as involving every act of our day. And so what I want to leave my children is a legacy of care, one aspect of which is formal philanthropy. I want them to understand the notion of philia as friendship, and then I want them to choose in their time and in their place and in their circumstances and with their conditions, I want them to choose their own path. Now, there's two extremes. Some parents say, it's my money, and those of us in this new financial advisement world really say it is their money and they should choose wisely what to do with it. And so they often, in their wisdom, set up a foundation to which they bind their children forever or for a period of time or to a cause, and that sometimes works perfectly, and at other times it is a very difficult output for the kids. It didn't really meet their true needs. The other extreme that I heard from one of my friends, who is about $50 million in wealth now after he's distributed some to his children, he said that it is his intent to give as much as possible. He's going to minimize taxation, but to give as much as possible to his children. Why? Because they are better parents now, he sees, than he was at their age, and they're already more caring people and philanthropic than he was at their age. And so he wants them to not only be caring, he wants them to have the great divine experience of choice, of discerning your own path. And so leaving a legacy of philanthropy is sometimes not providing the next generation with the joy of decision-making, searching out a cause, and applying your own talents and decision-making that was so joyful and fulfilling for the parents. They then want their kids to have everything that is deep, but they leave out the deepness of choice, exploration, and decision-making. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. No, I'm with you.
And I want us to be, in our advisement, to be more and more teaching people about philia, all the outputs that they can use, money, time, and skills, all the outputs of care, of friendship, of mutual nourishment, and not just formal philanthropy. Let me give you an example. When we did a study in the Boston area, we did a diary study. Some pretty high-up households, but mostly middle-income households. And what we found is that when people take together their dollars that they give to formal charity, about $1,400 a year, and then what these people did on average was another five times that amount in in-kind gifts, in financial support to their children, parents, and some friends. For instance, somebody has a daughter who's divorced. The grandparents and a couple kids, the grandparents bought all the school clothes. We're not talking about Christmas gifts now.
Mm-hmm.
They allow her to live in a flat that they previously rented. They give her a car. All of this is philia and is not the enemy, but the starting point for formal philanthropy. Philia, says Aristotle, first is experienced in that deep relationship between parent and child, where both are being nourished simultaneously. So
that's why I have you on three-dimensional wealth, Paul, because that's what we talk about, personal wealth, financial wealth, and social wealth, and how to sync them and put them together.
Right, and what I'm calling for is a way of life in our society and not just a formal philanthropic sector growing.
One thing I've seen, and now you go back to the advisor, there was an article recently in the Journal of Gift Planning,
mm-hmm.
and it said, one of the things that is going to affect wealth transfer, philanthropy, is longevity. Now, you were talking about those with $25 million, $100 million, and, they may never run out of funds. But then there's those that are sort of the everyday sort of wealthy, that can be a considerable dilemma or concern. And, what's your feeling or what do you see and how does that play in? I mean, do you see in your research that when someone has a heart for philia, that they throw out, some of the other cares and they say, well, that'll work its way out, or are they calculating? And they say, well, until I have all of my needs met, including investment and inflation and now longevity, then I'll consider it. I'd like to come back to that after the break, because you said, there are people that say, why yes am I giving and why no am I giving? And I'd like to know mm-hmm. what the research says when we come.
And when I give.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to come back. We've got one short section after we return from our break, but we'll be back with more three-dimensional wealth. Thank you.
The bottom line in business. Voice America Business.
Going nowhere as a financial professional? Enroll today at the American College. The American College is the nation's oldest and largest distance learning institution devoted to financial services education. Research has shown that graduates of the American College's Chartered Life Underwriter and Chartered Financial Consultant programs average 20% higher production income than their peers without professional designations. For more information, visit theamericancollege.edu. That's theamericancollege.edu, the education you need to succeed.
Financial planning can be confusing and complex, and unless you have a solid game plan, you could be taking unnecessary risks and missing out on tremendous opportunities. Let Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates take the mystery out of investing and help you build a solid financial foundation for years to come. Diefendorf Capital Planning revolves around the family, and through our financial service companies and three-dimensional wealth centers, we strive to deliver total wealth management financially, personally, and socially. Learn more about what Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates can do for you. Visit the website at diefendorfcapital.com today. Integrity, full service, best in class, diefendorfcapital.com.
Investment management is more than picking a good stock. In fact, a good company may not be a good investment. With today's complex financial products, it becomes critical to employ a true professional on your team. That's where the members of IMCA, the Investment Management Consultants Association, comes in. These professionals have proven themselves to be the best in the business. So when looking to get a second opinion on your portfolio, look for individuals with a CIMA designation. That's Certified Investment Management Analyst, a cut above the rest. Brought to you by the NYC chapter of IMCA.
The Internet's only all business and financial radio network, Voice America Business.
Bringing you the keys to total wealth management, this is Three-Dimensional Wealth with Roe Diefendorf. Comments or questions? Visit www.diefendorfcapital.com. Or call 516-759-3900. Now back to the show. Here's Roe Diefendorf.
I'm here with Paul Shervis. We're discussing philanthropy. And just before our break, we were talking about, you know, when. I mean, the research that you said is, you know, why do people say yes to philanthropy? Why do people say no? When do they do that? What's the research saying? And is there a point in time that, you know, it's only until they have all their needs met, or, as you were talking about, they do become really sort of outwardly focused. They do have this philia that's in them, and regardless of the financial part of this, they still are actively involved in philanthropy.
You see, it is something that moves toward a way of life in our society. Let me give you an example. When they play poker on MASH, nobody leaves the money on the table. There's always some cause, some need, for which that money is being earned or lost by those poker players, okay? Father Mulcahy's orphans, or money to send somebody to the States to study. Now, they play poker on Star Trek. And whenever the game is done, or they get interrupted in the game, nobody takes chips from the table. Because what they're playing for is no longer financial need. They've overcome financial need. But what's still needed in that Star Trek environment, the Star Trek culture, is philia. There may be no more need for formal philanthropy and the care for the poor, but there may be room for formal philanthropy in increasing the horizons of spiritual life, of cultural life, of music life. And so we're going to see philanthropy go through many, many stages of development over the next 30 years. And we're going to be addressing with formal philanthropy all kinds of new realms that we never thought would be addressed by philanthropy.
All right, if you get your crystal ball out, what's that going to look like? Can you take a guess?
Well, I think one thing is we're going to have huge amounts of money going overseas. And this money going overseas is not going to be parallel to government spending. It's going to be focused to grassroots organizations or organizations that are well-run. And they're going to try to avoid as much as possible the threats of corruption and siphoning off the money and bureaucracy. I think the other thing we're going to see is that more and more people will have a standard of living across the world, so that the economic question, as John Maynard Keynes put it, will no longer be of high priority for whole societies or whole groups or classes of people. And what's going to happen then, he predicts, and it's just like our model, it is, he says, then people will develop a new code of morals. So when we say, what is it going to look like 30 years from now or 50 years from now, we can look at it as a different material world. We can look at it as a different military world. We can look at it as a different biological and agricultural world. And we can look at it as a new and different social world and a new philanthropic world. I don't know what the material dimensions of all that will be, except that there's going to be great wealth and money that is available for philanthropy. But the bigger question is going to be the code of morals, the aspirations, the inspirations that is going to mobilize that money. That we know less about at the present. We're already seeing that when people become very wealthy, they have a natural inclination to remain active in shaping the world. They shaped it by business, now they want to shape it by philanthropy. The group that you are often in contact with and wonder about how they're, and they wonder how they're going to have enough money to live on and longevity, are a lot of people that came through the Depression. And they have deep concerns. Don't forget, these weren't, mostly weren't people that were parents during the Depression. They were children of the Depression.
Yeah.
And that may even have made a deeper impact on them because they were even in less control than their parents were during that age. And so they have this great fear of financial ruin being on the horizon. And with those people, I really think it is important to meet their true needs. See, financial advisors are a new caring industry. To the extent that they're meeting their clients' true needs rather than what they think their clients should be doing, they are meeting the really important role of counselor in the deepest sense of that term. And one of the things that people can be counseled about, are you worried about your money running out? Then we won't do anything that allows your money to run out. And if it gets toward the end of your life and you know your money's not going to run out, we can talk about having this done, the stuff that's in your estate, moved up for your last 6 months or last year of life if you decide to do it. But in the meantime, spend time with the organizations, indicate to the organizations how much you appreciate them, find out how much they appreciate you, and say, I'm not able to give it to you while I'm alive, but when I die, I want you to know this came from my heart. So this notion that it ought to be given in lifetime, or it ought to be a certain amount rather than at death, at a certain amount, I'm indifferent to. Because each of us has a different path and a different vocation, a different way to live out the will of God in our specific circumstances.
There's a show I did, Paul, and if any listeners want to take a look at it, it's on our website, dieffendorfcapital.com, but it was called A New Man Code. And it ties right in with what you're saying, and Dave Smith has written a book called A New Man Code.
Mm.
And we talked about it. And, I mean, a fabulous show, and more than we can talk about today, but if you're interested in taking putting it in your car and listening to it, that would be a great one.
Good idea.
Let me just go back. I just want to read again the mission statement for your organization. It says to discover, communicate, and apply multidisciplinary knowledge on moral biography in an age of affluence with a special focus on the personal meaning and practice of wealth, financial security, fundraising, and intergenerational transfer of wealth, financial planning, donor advisement, and the Ignatian model of discernment. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
That is what all the great teachers... Luther had elements of this, Calvin, Jonathan Edwards, Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas. This is what I was getting at. Instead of binding the future, what we want to do is provide an arena where our children are able to discern their own path. Discernment is conscientious self-reflection that has a negative side to it, where you clean out, where you dismiss, where you ward off certain anxieties and fears and become a more loving and attentive person. And then in that environment of a feeling of closeness to God, you choose what inspires you. See, the will of God in this Ignatian model is not found in the most difficult thing to do, even though what you end up doing may be difficult. And it's not found in the what other people want you to do. The will of God for Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits, is found in what you are most inspired to do if you are a good person.
What fun it would be to be a student of yours, Paul. I really envy those kids and the work that you're doing.
Well,
listen, the hour has gone quickly, I can tell you, and that's because you were with us.
Well, thank you so much. It was a great pleasure to be with you and to have the chance to talk seriously with somebody that is that interested in this.
Well, thanks again for joining us. I hope you enjoyed our conversation.
Absolutely.
And I invite you to join us next week at the same time for War of Three-Dimensional Wealth.
Voice America Business thanks you for tuning in to Three-Dimensional Wealth with Rory Diefendorf. Please join us again next Monday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time for more tips and strategies for achieving total wealth management on Three-Dimensional Wealth, right here on Voice America Business, the bottom line in business talk.